Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, California's Washington delegation takes on sexual assaults in the U.S. military, where not all the victims are women.
Men are a majority of the victims in our military. We cannot marginalize male survivors and send a message that men cannot be raped and therefore are not real survivors.
What will it take to change the military's culture? Also, it's kind of like the World Cup of Baseball. Teams from all over the globe competing this weekend in San Francisco for international bragging rights in any language, including Dutch.
They have things like Tweede Honkman, which is second baseman, Korte Stop, shortstop, and Werper is pitcher.
Those stories plus Californians saved from the Nazis as kids hold a reunion in Irvine. It's the California Report. There was emotional and disturbing testimony before a U.S. Senate committee this week. Survivors of sexual assault in the armed forces describing how the military's criminal justice system utterly failed to protect them or punish their attackers. One after another, female veterans and one man told stories of rape, assault, and sexual harassment. Gulf War vet and former Army Specialist Bridget McCoy described what happened to her on her first tour of duty.
I was raped during military service and during my first assignment. That was 1988. I was 18 years old. It was 2 weeks before my 19th birthday.
McCoy testified that despite years of pleading for help, the military justice system did not work.
Why did I have to go through so much before anyone would listen to me? Why did I have to be violated again through the process of asking for help and seeking claim status?
One big problem, military law allows commanders to unilaterally overturn guilty verdicts or reduce sentences handed down by military juries. In the House of Representatives, California Congresswoman Jackie Speier, a Democrat from San Mateo, introduced legislation to change that, and she joins us now from Washington, D.C. Congresswoman Speier, first of all, we heard testimony from military officials saying that they have zero tolerance for all this. So what does that mean to you? What does it say?
Well, zero tolerance is what is said every time that military brass are called up to the Hill after one travesty after another, after one scandal after another. They come up and say, we have zero tolerance for this. We will not tolerate this. And then they go back to business as usual. And the result is that we have victims out there that feel loath to come forward because they know what happens when they come forward. When they come forward, they get identified as having a personality disorder, an adjustment disorder, and before long, they are honorably but involuntarily discharged from the military. So we have 19,000 rapes and sexual assaults a year. That's a Department of Defense statistic. Only 13% report. And of those that report, very few of them go to court-martial, and even fewer, some 7%, actually have convictions. So to have a case actually go to court martial, to have a general handpick the jury, have the jury convict the assailant, demote him, and require him to be discharged from the military after 1 year of sentencing in jail, to have this general then turn around and dismiss the case as if it didn't happen is absolutely unbelievable. And what's most troubling about this is that the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States, the secretary of defense, has no ability to change the decision of someone who is not elected, who has that kind of extraordinary power. And so the Uniform Code of Military Justice has got to be amended.
Let me just come back to this point about the authority of the President and the Secretary of Defense. President Obama, former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, now Mr. Hagel, former Senator Hagel, they may not have the power, but they certainly have the bully pulpit, and they can, you know, call people into their office and demand change. Has that not happened over the past 4 years plus?
You have a lot of superstructure that exists within the military that will be there after the Secretary of Defense leaves, and they just slow-mo everything, or they do happy talk. So we create special victims units, and we'll finally give the victim a representation. But then they never enforce any of the laws or amendments to the National Defense Authorization Act that we put on the books. So it is an issue that requires us to take action now. We've got 20% of new recruits are women, with women now being able to serve in combat and then be promoted into very high positions because they're serving in combat. We have got to get this right.
One thing that surprised me is that this is not just women who are victims here. In fact, more than half of the victims are men.
That's correct. While it's a higher percentage of women, there's fewer women in the military. So about 10,000 of those 19,000 victims each year are men. And, you know, it's not sexual. It's about power. It's about imposing one's power over another.
During the hearing, Senator Barbara Boxer raised a troubling Bay Area link to this problem, a tragic problem that occurred in Santa Cruz last month, two police officers being shot and killed by a guy named Jeremy Peter Goulet, who had, as it turns out, rape charges against him dropped in 2006 when he was in the Army. Let's listen to Barbara Boxer here, and we'll come back and talk.
Now, what is it going to take to convince the military that sexual assault is a violent and vicious crime, and that those who perpetuate it, they're capable of other violent crimes, including murder?
Congresswoman Speer, let me ask you, what is it going to take before this changes?
It's going to take the will of members to stay on this issue. Because one of the big problems we have back here is what when the lights are on and the camera's rolling, members say the right thing. But then the lights go off, the cameras stop rolling, and they go on to another issue. This issue has suffered from not having people stay on it to fix it.
All right. Congresswoman Jackie Speer, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
As a city known for its car culture, Los Angeles has achieved a major milestone. All of its nearly 4,400 intersections with signals are now monitored and synchronized for better traffic flow. It's the first city in the world to do that, and the agency coordinating the effort, the Automated Traffic Surveillance and Control System, known as ATSAC, occupies a former bomb shelter in downtown L.A. Reporter Colin Berry hopped in his car to check it out.
The intersection of Hillhurst, Sunset, and Hollywood Boulevards is one of the craziest in L.A. Three major thoroughfares, each with their own left and right turn arrows, pedestrian crossings, and intricately orchestrated signal cycles that move traffic through a maze of 16 different lanes. During rush hour on a weekday, things can get a little backed up. In contrast to this street-level chaos, ATSAC's headquarters is a calm, quiet nerve center four stories under City Hall East. Here, a team of traffic engineers monitors more than a dozen screens showing live video feeds as well as animated graphics for every signalized intersection in L.A. Engineer Edward Yu, who oversees ATSAC, says gathering traffic data from the roads requires three things, the first of which lie beneath the pavement.
Loop detectors are these magnetic induction loops that are embedded in the ground, and they're really the eyes that we use to see the traffic. So as cars go over the loop detectors, it gives us data about the speed, the volume, and how long they've been sitting there.
The second component is cameras, more than 400 of them across the city, according to engineer Eric Zambin.
All of our cameras have pan, tilt, and zoom capabilities, and most of them are mounted on approximately 20 to 30-foot poles so that we can see the intersection that the camera is at and one intersection in each direction, ideally. Some of our cameras are mounted on high-rises so that we can see multiple intersections in multiple directions. We can get, 15, 20 traffic signals out of one camera.
Based on data from the loops, a proprietary algorithm developed by ATSAC determines demand on a given intersection. Then, based on time of day or scheduled events, like a Lakers game or the Academy Awards, it can modify a signal's timing in order to move traffic along. Hugh says it's all a balancing act.
We look at every intersection as a challenge, and we try to get it moving as efficiently as possible.
But has anyone noticed? Back at the triangle of Hollywood, Sunset, and Hillhurst, Philip Canton runs DiCarlo, a small wood-fired pizzeria, where he can make up to 40 deliveries a day. I asked him if he's noticed traffic moving more smoothly.
Recently, actually 2 days ago, I was going along Sunset, and for the first time, the traffic light seems to be synchronized. I thought it was just random, it was a coincidence, but apparently maybe it's not.
Okay, but this is L.A. What happens when there's a water main break or a police chase? Engineer Quan Tran says ATSAC's third component is human responsiveness.
If we know a particular leg is closed off, then we try to divert the traffic away from there and use signal timing to change the pattern and try to reroute the traffic to go around the area.
Signal synchronization in L.A. began 30 years ago to try to improve the flow of cars on the streets in time for the 84 Olympics. What's different today is that so many more factors are in play. Light rail crossings, bicycle lanes, school zones, even horseback riders who cross traffic in certain parts of the city. In Jewish neighborhoods on Saturdays, for example, pedestrians who need a walk light don't have to push a button.
We recognized that during the Sabbath that they were unable to touch anything mechanical, so we set the timing on recall, and that moves them across the intersection safely without, going away from their faith.
A system this complex and this adaptive is undermining LA's reputation for terrible traffic. Still, Edward Yu says there's always something to improve.
The city's always growing. It's always developing. We're looking at ways to improve our existing system, upgrading our system, expanding it in such a way, using our data to give more motorist information out there. There's a lot of different ways we're looking at. It's just going to take a matter of time before we develop the next big thing.
ATSAC's specialized software can apparently be customized. The agency just licensed copies to the cities of Gilroy and Long Beach and hopes to sell it to Washington, D.C. as well. For the California Report, I'm Colin Berry in Los Angeles.
This year marks the 75th anniversary of Kinder Transport. The program shuttled Jewish children out of Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Poland before the Nazis tried to wipe out the Jewish populations there. Many of those Kinder, now mostly in their 80s, eventually ended up in California. Susan Vallett caught up with a couple of them at a recent reunion in Irvine.
About 100 people roam a hotel lobby, including 36 Kinder, plus their adult children and grandchildren. Some scribble messages on easels of paper. They're reminiscent of the size of milk cartons. Does anyone know a Fritzi Hacker from Berlin? Does anyone know Susie Rosenstock from Worms? German native Hilda Fogelson steps outside. She remembers growing up in Berlin. Fogelson says at first it was okay, but then things started to change.
The kids would put rocks in the snowballs, and they knew we were Jewish because we were going to the subway to go to Jewish school. They would try and hit us with those, things like that. Every day something happened.
Then came Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass, in November of 1938. Rioters in Germany and Austria destroyed Jewish businesses and burned down synagogues. Fogelson says her dad took her and her sister on the streetcar to see the aftermath so they'd never forget it.
As we were going along, we could see the synagogue burning that I went to. We could see a lot of stores with the name Judah, Jew, and the store windows broken. My father had told us before we shouldn't say anything, people shouldn't realize we were Jewish. That woke my dad up. Up to that point, he always thought that's a passing thing. The world is not going to let this happen.
After Kristallnacht, activists in England pressured officials there to approve the transport of Jewish children out of Nazi-occupied areas. But families would have to pay a guarantee of 50 British pounds per child, a lot of money for the time. Quakers helped escort the children. Fogelson's dad paid to get 13-year-old Hilda and her two sisters to England. Around the same time, 7-year-old Susie Goldsmith's father, a well-known attorney, got her and her brother on the first Kinder transport out of Vienna.
The day that the train left, all the grandparents and the aunts and uncles went to the station, but nobody was allowed near the children. They were all kept far away from the children. And all I remember is I cried from that moment till I think we got out of Austria, out of Germany, and into Holland.
The Kinder transport lasted 9 months until World War II brought it to an end. About 60% of the children never saw their parents again. Both Fogelson and Goldsmith, on their separate journeys, eventually made it to California. Goldsmith's family went to San Francisco.
And it was wonderful. I made very good friends. Nobody believed the stories that we told, so we learned not to talk about our experiences. Nobody thought that a civilized country could be so cruel.
At the Kinder Transport Association reunion, Kinder and their families hold hands and snake through the room, singing a song of peace. They attend sessions about how to keep their long-hidden stories alive. Goldsmith's adult daughter, Ellen Goldsmith.
Where most American Jews have like a mezuzah on the outside of the house, we didn't. It was absolutely forbidden. It was on the inside of the house, but not on the outside where it could be seen publicly. And when I wanted to wear a Star of David when I was 7, and my mother said no. And I said, I'll buy it. She said, no. As it turned out, I did buy it. I did wear it. And she was terrified for me.
Ellen Goldsmith says it wasn't until years later that she made the connection between her Star of David and the yellow star her mother was forced to wear to identify her as a Jew. Both Kinder Hilda Fogelson and Susie Goldsmith speak to schools in California about their experiences. Fogelson says she's even spoken to kids in Germany.
The young people that I speak to there, they weren't even alive. And they sometimes ask that question, do you hate us? And I say, no, I don't hate you, but your grandparents. It's not very nice, but that's the truth.
Fogelson says she's shown her family where she lived in Berlin.
After a while, I just want to leave. I said, I can't be here any longer. But sort of felt it's important that I do it, too. You know, that this, the Germans see, they didn't kill us all. I'm alive.
It's a lesson that resonates with the 86-year-old's children, who say while their mother's experience is tinged with pain, it's also a source of pride. For the California Report, I'm Susan Vallett in Irvine.
And we've got photos of the Kinder Transport reunion along with some historical images. Check them out at our website, californiareport.org. Most of us try to do it 7 or 8 hours a night, talking, of course, about sleep. We're devoting a whole show to the topic next month, and whether you sleep like a log or toss and turn all night, we want to hear from you. Drop us a line and tell us your sleep story in the middle of the night if you're wide awake. Send email to calreport@kqed.org. Tell us what keeps you up and what helps you sleep. Again, that's calreport@kqed.org. Back in the days of vinyl, before CDs were king, a record's fate could rise or fall on the strength of its cover art. On his new CD, Roads and Codes, Bay Area trumpeter Ian Carey has put almost as much creative energy into the album's package as his music. The California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert has this review.
Trumpeter Ian Carey possesses a bright, gleaming tone and a knack for attracting similarly accomplished musicians. featuring material gleaned from sources far beyond jazz's usual ken. His new album, Roads and Codes, reflects a singular vision, musical and otherwise. A graphic designer by day, he also maintains a smart and often savagely funny blog. Carey turned his CD's cover into a self-mocking comic strip. The art depicts his quandary over how to present a new jazz album so that it might actually find an audience. On the back, his manga-inspired illustrations suggest the mindset with which he approaches each piece. While not presented as a suite, the album flows like an interlaced book of short stories. Carey's Rain Tune. It's a programmatic piece that evokes the course of a spring shower on a windowpane. From the moisture-laden prelude and the refreshing downpour to the crisp calm that follows the storm. He's equally evocative on Neil Young's disquieting theme from Jim Jarmusch's surreal 1995 Western, Dead Man. With its simple chord changes, it's the kind of piece many jazz musicians would avoid, but Carey turns it into a haunting soundscape, processing his horn with multiple effects to suggest the tune's rock origins. Carey's quintet features some of the Bay Area's best players, including pianist Adam Schulman, bassist Fred Randolph, and drummer John Arkin. The only newcomer to this long-running band is the reliably incisive alto saxophonist Casey Knudsen. She adds a jolt of quicksilver energy to the front line with flutist and tenor saxophonist Evan Francis. Like on Count Up, Carey's punchy take on the chord changes to John Coltrane's harmonic steeplechase, Countdown. Carey saves his most personal music for last, concluding the album with a modernist three-piece mini-suite that erases distinctions between jazz and classical music. He sandwiches his rustic, bluesy composition, The Thread, between Stravinsky's brief and sublime Andante and Charles Ives' majestic West London. Some jazz fans treasure swaggering trumpeters who spit fire, but that's not where Carey is coming from. Roads and Codes is the work of a musician pursuing his own poised, painterly vision. If his witty graphics help him find new listeners, this is one case where you're unlikely to go wrong judging an album by its cover.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed Roads and Codes by the Ian Carey Quintet, plus one. Well, believe it or not, opening day for Major League Baseball is just over 2 weeks away. But for those who just can't wait, the championship round of the World Baseball Classic starts this weekend in San Francisco. Event organizers pitch it as the premier international baseball tournament. The California Report's Nina Thorson talked to some of the fans who'll be there.
Teams from 28 countries entered the qualifying rounds of the World Baseball Classic last September. The final round will feature just four. They include the Dominican Republic, where they call the game baseball, Japan, where it's yakyu, and the Netherlands, where they say
honkbal.
Natasha Chatelain works at the Dutch consulate in San Francisco.
Honk is a not a goalpost, but a base, yeah, and yeah, ball. Yeah, the ball, indeed, yeah. Honkball is what we say.
The term honkball has been unexpectedly successful, like the Dutch team itself, who will play in the tournament on Monday. The hashtag honkball has been trending on Twitter, thanks to fans like Ian Miller of Oakland, who wrote an article about it for Baseball Prospectus.
What they did was just literally translate English language baseball terms into Dutch. They have things like tweede honkman, which is second baseman, korte stop, shortstop, and werper is pitcher. And I kind of needed to throw my lot in with the team, so why not pick these guys who were making me laugh?
The Dutch terminology may seem funny, but they're seriously talented. Manager Hensley Meulens is the hitting coach for the San Francisco Giants. Pitching coach Bert Blyleven is a Hall of Famer. The players include major leaguers like Andrew Jones, who's from a special part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands, the Caribbean island of Curaçao. So is the consulate's Natasha Chatelain.
Oh my God, baseball's huge on the island. You know, every little kid, when they're playing outside, they're playing with a stick and a ball or a stick and a stone, hitting that. There's little baseball leagues and baseball teams all over the place. And it's just a tradition on the island, playing baseball. Everybody wants to be the next one to be scouted.
The consulate is organizing a cheering section for Dutch expats, but the other teams have their local fans too. Larry Cruz of Elk Grove is coming to Sunday's game with his wife, Kaoru, who's originally from Japan. Their son, Anton, asked for the tickets as his 13th birthday present when they found out Japan would be in the finals. The Cruz family has been following the WBC games being played in Asia, which start at 3 a.m. Pacific time.
We're fanatics, but we're not nuts, so I TiVo them. Yeah, and I'm because I'm usually the one getting breakfast ready and lunches ready. I'm usually the first one that, you know, flips on to see what the score was. So as I'm getting them up, their first question is, hello, Dad, or, you know, did you sleep well? How did Japan do?
Another family who will be in the stands, Elaine Allen and her daughter, Julia Seaman. Allen's a professor of biostatistics at UCSF. And in her spare time, she writes about baseball statistics.
It would be cool if the Netherlands won, but I think I'm rooting for the Dominican just because they have such great players. And they didn't win last time. We've had, you know, Japan has won the last two times. I think it would be great for the Dominican to win.
Beyond longtime fans like Allen, Major League Baseball hopes the WBC will appeal to people who didn't grow up with America's pastime, like Dominic Johnson of Marin County, who's originally from England.
Ever since moving over here 8 years ago, I've been hooked on the baseball bug. And I really like the idea of being able to go and see multiple different countries play together, because after all, the World Series is not really a World Series.
Back at the Dutch consulate, Natasha Chatelain's put her regular job as science and technology advisor on hold for a few days. Instead, she's been doing things like arranging for this dance group to fly in from Curaçao. They'll perform at Monday's game before the honkballers take the field in San Francisco. For the California Report, I'm Nina Thorson.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us online at californiareport.org, and we're on Facebook, too. Like us, if you like. And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Schaefer. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. Our editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation. With nomination information about the 2014 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards available at www.irvine.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens in neighborhoods at calendow.org.